you to our community for supporting us for the past 10 years. Again, that's Bracelet of Hope's 10th Anniversary Summer Festival on August 13th from 12 to 7 p.m. at Royal City Park, a physically accessible venue. To volunteer, become a vendor, or for more information, please visit www.braceletofhope.ca or call 226-790-3824. Hope to see you there!
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
The dead won't let me sleep. The living won't let me die in peace. My heart filled with a yesterday that never happened. My hands filled with my face. My long breaths bleeding between my fingers. I killed myself once, but my lives are plural. That's why I can speak to the immoral like I'm immortal. The mind is fertile. Birth of verse with no epidural. The truth hurts. Speaking life into the dead as if it's normal. This is the lion-hearted. The fire starter. The sound and the fury. William Faulkner. The color purple. Alice Walker. Canterbury Tales. Geoffrey Chaucer. Every people was sent a prophet, but also every people was sent an imposter. Likewise, every people have been sent an author to tell their story. This is a tale of what turns a man into a monster and what turns that monster into a martyr. In a shadow of untold trauma, the secret art of how to unfold karma and the divine unknown drama, true and living. We're just trying to make black history, but it's like they're trying to make blacks history and won't even write a eulogy for you and me. Misery loves company, but the company loves misery. The company will co-op your story and sell your minstrel show in HD. Our suffering seen more vividly. Obviously, niggas are NSFW. They don't want to pay you but peddle you, or just petty cash to settle you. That's why it's hard to employ me, but even harder to ignore me. The irony isn't lost on me how they made slaves of the masters of ceremonies. Ha, clever, me, never. They like their bitches spayed, niggas neutered. Nigga babies carefully tutored to be foolish, yet ruthless, to eat garbage and drink sewage, to the point where even saying African American sounds like a nigga Judas. The American dream is a love song gone wrong, a fantasy long gone. But if you knew this and still wanna be a slave, then you stupid and useless. I'm gonna tell you straight. This ain't no shucking and jiving picketing, nigga. This the pick of the litter, alpha male. You still smell like infamil, imbecile. I'm Oscar Grant, still mourning Emmett Till. I'm Emmett Smith, no NFL. Running and juking in the killing fields. But them killing fields deadly enough even to make Emmett still. I admit still, shooken up every time I see Emmett's grill. Until my molars spark and I taste battery acid. And maybe that's too drastic. Maybe I'm overreacting. Maybe seeing dead babies shouldn't faze me. But it does. It does. It does. Are we not flesh and bone? Are we not minds and souls? Our eyes either blind or closed, as if we don't see, as if we don't know. They'll kill you. They'll kill you. They'll kill you like it's no biggie, no diddy. While we arguing over who the king of New York City, they emasculate the greats. Bye, Black Panther, Hello Kitty, or slowly assassinate the greats. Goodbye, Whitney. You can see the future if you learn history. I'm speaking to you straight and right. They got you leaning left like 450. Whether wealth, weed, or women, have you chasing dimes, wasting time. Wait. Wealth, weed, women, chasing dot. Wow, that's a triple double entendre and alliteration at the same damn time. Okay, so the Sufi can rhyme. Can we not have another conversation about your top five dead or alive? Instead, can we talk about the top 1% and the bottom 99? Or the wise 5% and the deaf, dumb, and blind 85? Or how the circle 7 and the 120 saved our lives? On the boat with Jesus' name, Lucifer came. And then proof of our name went poof, David Blaine. Disappeared between the noose and the chains. Euthanasia introducing the youth to the cane. So we singing and rapping, attempts at reducing the pain. We don't know what else to do with the pain. We don't know what else to do with the pain. They say rap for us and then they clap for us. Are you not entertained? Standing on my brother's body, are you not entertained? Caring son's carcass. Are you not entertained? But even with all the battery and the abuse, we are still so beautiful. Our babies like balls of light, bright enough to brighten the darkness of the battlefield. But when I look into my daughter's face, it only reminds me that there's a battle still, and that the battle's real, and that a draw is a win for losers. We must win. The truth is, when I said the sky is mine, by mine I meant I and I. By I meant you and I. The sky is ours. Heaven's fallen. We either fly or die. We must win. We have died so many times. They have killed us so many times. We have died so many deaths. We have died for everyone. We have died for everything. We have died for nothing. We are done with death. We are done with death. We will not die another day. We are the true and living, and we must win.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU, I am Siegfried. That was Amir Suleiman with We Must Win. Spoken word poem of his. I just want to begin with that I do not believe that there is sufficient information for me to comment on or make an effective analysis of the events that happened recently in Dallas, Texas. The only thing I can say about this is that it came in the aftermath of two very public slayings of black men by police in Minnesota and Louisiana. The courageous action of Black Lives Matter Toronto activists at Pride 2016, where they temporarily shut down the parade in protest of the heavy police presence. And in the aftermath of an overall rising tide of organizing and protest across North America against racist police brutality and murder of black people. What can be said for certain is that in the wake of what happened in Dallas, the capitalist state and mainstream media in both America and in Canada is trying to shut down this wave of protest and effective mass organization, trying to equate Black Lives Matter in particular with terrorism and violence, with some reactionary commentators even comparing them to ISIS. This is a dangerous moment, and it could very well signal the beginning of a major state crackdown on dissent. Many of the communists I am acquainted with in Texas are justifiably worried right now, given the repression that could very easily come their way as a result of this. Not only from the state, but from militiamen and right-wing vigilantes who are out for blood right now. Once again, it is very important that we put this situation in historical context. So before I get into the main body of the show, I want to play this discussion of race, class, and American history by historian Gerald Horn. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Welcome back to the Real News Network, and reality asserts itself. We're going to continue our discussion with Gerald Horn, but first I'm going to read a quote which I read at the beginning of the first segment. Men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living. That was Karl Marx in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, written in 1852. Well, one of the things weighing on the brains of Americans is the concept of whiteness. At least half of voting America has voted against Barack Obama, and many of them, according to polling, voted against him because he was black. It's an underlying theme of American culture and politics, anything from gun control to how one looks at crime and mass incarceration rates. Racism runs deep and permeates the American psyche, but much of it comes from this nightmare weighing on people's brains from the past. And here's a quote from Gerald Horne's book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the USA. The construction of whiteness, or the forging of bonds between and among European settlers across class, gender, ethnic, and religious lines, was a concrete response to the real dangers faced by all of these migrants in the face of often violent rebellions from enslaved Africans and their indigenous comrades. Now joining us to talk about these slave rebellions and the role they played in the creation of America is Gerald Horne. Gerald's published over 30 books. He's a former executive director of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. And as I said, his most recent book is The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the USA. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, there's lots of people talk about the American Revolution in terms of class, in terms of class struggle. But the class usually talked about is this American elite, the rising American owner class, and how they wanted freedom and they wanted to be free of British colonialism. Mm-hmm. There's not a heck of a lot of talk of what role working people played in mm-hmm. this, but there's almost no talk about what the black slaves played. Mm-hmm. And in fact, instead of describing the revolution as this great explosion of democracy, you call it a counter-revolution. So we're going to work our way through your book. Mm-hmm. So start the story.
Well, the short response is that the revolt against British rule in mainland North America in 1776 was inspired in no small part by the fact that London was moving towards abolition of slavery, as evidenced by Somerset's case in June 1772, which, among other things, tended to ban slavery in England. And there was a perception on the mainland that it would be easy for that ruling to work its way across the Atlantic to the North American mainland settlements.
And then why were the British heading towards abolition?
Well, there hangs a tale. It depends on where you want me to enter the story. The short answer is that Britain was under enormous competitive pressure to move away from slavery. This was due in part to the fact that the Spanish in Florida, which they controlled intermittently from the 1500s up until 1821, had been arming Africans throughout that entire period, and had been sending Africans from Spanish Florida and also from Spanish Cuba to pillage, plunder, and devastate British settlements in the Carolinas, in Georgia, in Virginia. This was putting pressure on Britain to likewise arm Africans, not least because there was a perception in London that some of those who were under London's jurisdiction, such as the Irish, for example, who had been colonized hundreds of years previously, were not necessarily reliable politically, nor the Scots, who may be seceding from the UK within weeks and who had only come under London's jurisdiction in 1707.
I mean, the Scots were far closer to the French than they were to the English.
Correct. And so there was a real perception that these nationals of the UK were not reliable politically, and then there was a competitive pressure from Spain, and also a certain kind of competitive pressure from the French in Quebec as well, because oftentimes in New York State, and also in the colony that was Massachusetts, you would have French trying to stir up the Africans in that part of North America against the British. However, this idea that the British were going to move towards abolition of slavery, not to mention arming Africans, encountered a wall of resistance in the North American settlements, because their idea was not to arm Africans. Their idea was to manacle and handcuff and march at gunpoint into the fields every African in sight. So this was part of the fissure that develops between the metropolis in London and the settlements that is detonated in July 1776. Now, of course, you could go back further to talk about how that story actually begins, which was with another revolution, the so-called Glorious Revolution in England, 1688, which, among other things, causes a reduction in power of the monarch, the king, as against the rising influence and power of the merchant class. This has a particular relevance to the African slave trade because the Royal African Company had been under the thumb of the monarch. But what happens with the Glorious Revolution is what I call the inauguration of free trade in Africans. The trade is deregulated, so to speak. Free trade is inaugurated, which causes the merchants to descend upon the African continent with the demented energy of crazed bees manacling and handcuffing every African in sight, dragging them across the Atlantic, particularly to the Caribbean, Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua, which up until the middle of the 18th century, London felt was more valuable than the mainland. However, the problem there was that oftentimes in these islands, the Africans were outnumbering the Europeans by a ratio of 20-1, which created fertile conditions for slave rebellions, which broke out with repetitive monotony. Antigua, 1709, 1736, the Maroons in Jamaica, who had basically escaped London's jurisdiction and were basically seeming to augur the collapse of the entire colonial project in Jamaica, which, because of its sugar, was seen as one of the most valuable pieces of real estate on planet Earth. So London was facing pressure to either have abolition of slavery in a helter-skelter manner, being chased out of the Caribbean by angry Africans, or more measured abolition. But abolition, whether helter-skelter or measured, was on the agenda, and that was not pleasing to mainland settlers.
Washington, mainland being United States mainland.
Exactly, North American mainland.
I mean the colonies at the time.
Exactly. Many of whom, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Madison, Patrick Henry, were all slave owners. Even a future U.S. president who was not necessarily involved in slavery, John Adams, was a lawyer for slave owners. John Hancock, whose name appears on the founding document, was one of the key slaveholders in Massachusetts, for example. You have to realize that slavery was not a sideshow. There is evidence to suggest that slave voyages and slavery itself was one of the most lucrative enterprises ever devised in the brain of human beings, sometimes profits of 1,700%. And as you know, living in North America, there are those today within a stone's throw of the studio who would sell their firstborn for a profit of 1,700%, let alone an African they did not know.
Let me ask you one sort of economic question here. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, I mean, Europe had gone through a whole stage of slave society and moves mm-hmm. to feudalism. Serfdom mm-hmm. Was a more consistent way with the technology of the time of exploiting labor than slavery was. I mean, slaves rebel, and sometimes they break their tools and plows, and serfs are a little more controllable in theory. Why was slavery so productive, in a sense, in North America, and especially in the South?
Well, U.S. historians today generally argue that despite these, quote, problems you've just articulated, slavery remained profitable up to the time it was abolished in the United States in 1865. And an entire superstructure had developed to justify slavery. What I mean is the ideology that the Africans were inferior, that if Africans were enslaved, they would butcher each other. And this,
you got to dehumanize those you enslave.
Of course. But this also provides momentum and an impetus to continue slavery as well, because many people felt that they were rescuing these Africans from a benighted African continent by bringing them across the Atlantic. They were being, quote, Christianized, unquote. And so therefore, it was seen as something of a benevolent enterprise by all too many.
So the reason all this matters is because you're arguing much of this structural racism and this strength of the far right, particularly in white south of the United States. Mm-hmm. This is part of this. It's an outgrowth of this history. This culture has been created, as we in the quote, it weighs on people's minds. They're born into this and kind of nurtured and educated in this culture of white supremacy and whiteness as a concept. So this ain't just about some history for the sake of, isn't this interesting? This is about what we're facing today has its roots here, and if we want to get at it, you need to know the roots. So start us off where the book starts.
Well, you may recall that just a few moments ago in talking about growing up in St. Louis, I made a reference to something I called the Black Scare. And I cited examples of this fear about black people in North America. They'll carjack you, they'll eat your babies, and all the rest. And this becomes problematic when the time comes to organize people on a class basis, when you have this racial divide and this racial fear and racial hysteria. It oftentimes, such as in Louisiana in 1991, causes people to vote for the far right, that is to say, white Americans. As I talk about in the book...
Just to remind people, this is when they vote for David Duke.
A Nazi and a Klansman.
He's a Nazi, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite remarkable. It requires deep and intense study. If you look at how and why loyal subjects of the British Crown revolted in North America against constituted authority, that's what a revolution is. You have to understand that in a place like North Carolina, for example, one of the major reasons they revolted was fear of the Black Scare, which I just talked about with regard to the 20th century and the 21st century. That is to say, there was a fear that Britain was going to arm Africans to squash and discipline settler discontent, for example, over taxes. For example, this is where the traditional story enters the picture.
And Africans had a reason to do this because the English are moving towards abolition, and so they're offered the chance of freedom if they make this alliance.
They thought that they would get a better deal. You have to realize that history oftentimes does not present pristine and simple choices between good guys and bad guys. Oftentimes it's choosing between who has a dirty shirt and who has a very dirty shirt. And with regard to 1776, many of the Africans decided that Britain just had a dirty shirt and the settlers had a very dirty shirt. It's not unlike the so-called Anglo-Boer War, 1899 to 1902 in South Africa, where settlers, so-called Boer settlers, descendants of Dutch migrants, revolted against British rule. And you'll find that virtually to a man and woman, the African majority in South Africa sided with the Union Jack. They sided with the British. It's not because they thought the British were heroes or good guys. It's just that they felt that they had the cleanest dirty shirt, so to speak, compared to the Boer settlers. And they were probably right. And I dare say that with regard to 1776, it should not come as a surprise that almost by an order of magnitude, the Africans sided with the Crown against the settlers, which also helps to explain the continuing animus against people of African descent, not least descendants of mainland enslaved Africans, because of the fact that we, and I use the term we, rebelled against this supposedly heroic project establishing the United States of America. It also sheds light on the fact of why I say in the book that racism, the term I use and have probably used in this conversation, is a necessary but insufficient explanation of what has befallen people of African descent in North America. Because if racism were sufficient, then it would do little to explain why it was that in the 1950s and 1960s, when African diplomats started coming to the United States and coming to this area and traveling up the highway from Washington to New York and stopping at segregated enterprises in Maryland, that the State Department wanted to give these African diplomats buttons to wear on their lapels so that they could be distinguished from we U.S. Negroes. Now, if these people were racist, they treat the African diplomats terribly, too. They're dark skinned, darker than I am. But they're making distinctions between and amongst them. I think partly the condition of black people can be explained as a political condition. As much as it can be explained as a condition of racism.
The book, the title of the first chapter is How Caribbean Slavery Came to the Mainland. And I think a lot of what's unique about your work is this unraveling or explanation of the close association to what happened to the Caribbean and the United States and the slave trade back and forth.
Well, absolutely. You have to realize that these colonies were not a unitary project. They were not one unit, that is to say, mainland of North America, Jamaica, or Antigua, Barbados. But there was a certain commonality and unity between and amongst them. And surely when you had slave revolts, as you had frequently in the Caribbean because of the ratios, sometimes the Europeans being outnumbered 20 to 1, the settlers in these Caribbean islands made a great trek from Jamaica, Antigua, Barbados in particular, to the North American mainland, oftentimes bringing their Africans in tow, oftentimes helping to bolster the European settler enterprise in the Carolinas and in Virginia, and helping to give a shot of adrenaline to the slave system in North America. That's part of the explanation of how there's this unity of interest between the Caribbean and the North American mainland.
And you mentioned in the earlier segment, talk a bit more just how important the slave rebellions were in the shaping of the politics of the time.
Well, first of all, it helps to infuse the Black Scare. I mean, when I was writing this book, some of my editors were suggesting to me that I was going overboard in talking about African resistance, shipboard insurrections, mass poisoning plots. Poison, for example, was a particular tool of enslaved women under slavery.
They're preparing the food for the slave master.
Exactly. Arson is a continuing problem. Having your throat slit in the middle of the night is a continuing problem. And so obviously this is helping to infuse the Black Scare. People become afraid of dark-skinned people. Some might say for good reason. But it's the system under which all of these people are forced to labor that's creating this violence. And one can make an argument that this systemic violence is still with us to a degree, helping to shed light on the amazing number of gun crimes in the United States, the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which has been interpreted, as you know, to give citizens the right to bring their guns openly into a Starbucks in Texas, for example. I think you can't understand what seem to be bizarre episodes unless you understand the roots of these bizarre episodes.
So this period of the tremendous growth and expansion of the slave economy and the massive profits achieved, it's the basis of, is it, how much, I guess, is the question, is it the basis of what then becomes the industrialization of America and the banking system and all the what becomes the more modern infrastructure?
This is not a new idea, even though I think it's something I try to dig into on perhaps a deeper, more profound level than has been dug into previously. That is to say that Eric Williams, a founding father of Trinidad and Tobago, in his books Capitalism and Slavery, that came out 70 years ago, wrote about this. Walter Rodney, the late great Guyanese historian, wrote about this in his book How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. It's, you cited Karl Marx at the top of this interview. Of course, Karl Marx wrote about this in Capital, about how the system of capitalism enters upon the world stage with the blood of Africans gushing from every pore. In terms of what Marx talks about in terms of primitive accumulation, the fuel that leads to the takeoff of the system largely comes from the African slave trade. Slavery was not a sideshow. It was not a sectional issue. What I mean by a sectional issue is that it wasn't just a product of the South, Virginia going southward, because it was financed from the North, New York in particular, but also Rhode Island, also Boston. Not only that, but it was not only financed from these areas. Oftentimes the ships left from these areas, and so therefore when you had shipboard insurrections, there were nationals from Rhode Island who were being massacred, which helped to unite those Rhode Islanders on the basis of antipathy towards African with Virginians and Georgians and Carolinians. So slavery provides the fuel for the development of this modern society that some are able to enjoy, which is one of the reasons why when I used to have conversations with certain friends from abroad about how they wanted to build a society like the United States, well, I would say, well, you know, find millions of people to work for free for a few centuries, and you can have a modern society too. And I think that this is oftentimes lost sight of, particularly when it comes to talking about reparations for slavery, the free labor that Africans provided to this country. Many people would suggest, well, you know, my relatives only came here 30 years ago, so what do I have to do with slavery? But you're enjoying a society which was built upon the backs not only of enslaved Africans, but I should also say, built upon the back of land that was taken from the indigenous population. And one of the points I try to stress in this particular book is not only the fact that slavery was an impetus for 1776, but also a proclamation that London had made in circa 1763 to keep the settlers from moving steadily west, seizing the land of the indigenous, because that led to clashes, which led to London having to send redcoats and London was trying to contain India at that particular moment in history. It was jousting with the Spanish and Cartagena.
There was a big debate going on in amongst the English elite at the time whether this whole colonial project isn't just a boat anchor. This whole thing's just costing too much.
You are correct. And so when these settlers are then pushing further west, coming into conflict with Native Americans and First Nations peoples, indigenous people, it's draining the exchequer in London. And that's leading to a fissure. That's leading to a split of opinion between mainland North American opinion and settled opinion in London, which erupts in a revolt against British rule, leading to the formation of the United States of America.
All right, we're going to continue this discussion with Gerald Horn on Reality Asserts Itself, so please.
If I say I want peace, then you say, well, you should put down your gun. But hasn't it occurred to you by now, after 400 years of being brutalized and murdered and lynched and maimed by guns and force on the part of racists and the racist power structure in this country, it's damn near time we picked up the gun to try to begin to get some peace, to defend ourselves and our community from racist attacks by the pigs, to defend ourselves against racist attacks by Birchites or Minutemen or Ku Klux Klansmen or what have you? Hasn't it occurred to you that it's damn near time we organize ourselves in some fashion to have some ability to begin to make racist and the racist power structure act in a desired manner as we define the functional definition of what power is? The ability to define the situation, and we have been defining it. Now we must organize in our black communities to also make the power structure and the racist system act in a desired manner. And what is that desired manner? Politics. What is politics? What is politics? You think politics starts with a seat in the assembly? No, it doesn't. It's related to it, but it doesn't start there. Politics starts with a hungry stomach. Politics starts with a pig crushing us across our skull and murdering our people. Politics starts with the fact that we get rotten education, we get brainwashed and fooled and the trick notion and trick knowledge and everything else that goes on with us in terms of the exploitation that goes down. Politics starts with the fact that we want decent housing, fit for shelter of human beings. Now this is where politics starts. And black people now understand with the Black Panther Party that we are going to relate to politics in a real fashion. We are not going for no more jive verbal sincerity at all. Don't give me, Robert F. Kennedy, your jive shuck. I think it is necessary here that we come forth. I don't want to hear it. I'm tired of my black brother being brainwashed too. Kingfish, what did you think about John F. Kennedy? Robert Kennedy? Well, Andy, you know how it go there, boy. I think the boy is going to do something there. Look, we're not going for that thing anymore. Robert F. Kennedy was well related to Robert Williams being put in a situation where he had to vamp from this country and split because he was being prosecuted by Robert F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy did not send troops into Birmingham in 1963 until black people decided it was necessary for them to defend themselves. When Martin Luther King's motel was bombed and the races had been attacking us constantly in that particular area and all over this country, why didn't John F. Kennedy send some troops in then? He didn't send troops in until after black people decided we're going to defend ourselves from racist attacks and went to the streets and whooped up a few racist heads. Then John F. Kennedy decided to send in troops. See, all that verbal sincerity, we learn from the past. We learn. So we're going to guide our feet by the lamps of the past. And we're going to make sure that we won't fall into more bags. So peace and freedom, if you want to do something, get down to nitty gritty and don't miss no nits or grits. No more shucking and no more jiving with the McCarthys, with the Lynching Baines Johnson, with the Governor Regans, with the Robert F. Kennedys, right on down the line. No more shucking and jiving.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And that was Bobby Seale with No More Shucking and Jiving. And then we, of course, had Gerald Horn with the Counter-Revolution of 1776. Talking about the real history of slavery in America and the real root of apartheid in American society. I've been talking for the last several episodes of Back in the USSR about different aspects of my book, Proletarian God, Building the Socialist Future. And what I want to talk about today is the subject of Chapter 9, which is entitled The Universalist Order and Executive Authority. This chapter discusses revolutionary leadership in the context of the socialist state and what form that leadership will take in the Universal Republic. If you recall, last week I talked about the Proletarian Guard, the mass organization of proletarians that forms the legislative branch of government in the Universal Republic. This week I'm going to talk about the Universalist Order, the organization that will be responsible for executive authority in the Universal Republic and which might be described as the officer corps or general staff of the international proletariat. You know, this leadership group. This group providing revolutionary leadership to the masses. I think it's important to begin by stressing why revolutionary leadership is necessary in the first place. Anarchists, for example, would have us believe that there is no need for authority figures or hierarchical structures at all in revolutionary movements, and that such things can only serve to undermine and corrupt revolutionary movements. Of course, just about every anarchist movement, from the Zapatistas to the anarchist elements within the Occupy movement, had leaders. You know, leaders who generally denied that they were leaders, and people in positions of power, but overall they reject these things as authoritarian, oppressive, and even counter-revolutionary. But communists don't have the same view on leadership. Given the nature of the capitalist state and the brutal forces it can unleash, communists understand that effective leadership is vital in revolutionary movements. There must be coordination, there must be effective organization, there must be a central authority that has the power to discipline, and there must be political unity. Without these things, no revolutionary movement or government can hope to succeed, and history bears this out. The French Revolution could not have been sustained without the leadership of the Jacobins. The Russian Revolution could not have survived without the leadership of the Bolsheviks. The Chinese Revolution could not have triumphed without the leadership of the Communist Party. And the same could be said of Cuba, Vietnam, Nicaragua, and essentially every other revolution in the modern era. Even revolutions that initially come about as a result of mass indignation, spontaneous organization, and the breakdown of state institutions, such as the February Russian Revolution of 1917, could not have endured if revolutionary institutions like the Bolshevik Party and the Petrograd Soviet had not centralized power and created the foundations for a new socialist state that was then able to fight off armed reactionary forces and invading foreign armies during the Russian Civil War. Revolutions that fail to do this will either be destroyed, as the Catalonian anarchists definitely were during the Spanish Civil War, or be co-opted by reactionary forces, as happened in Egypt in 2011, when the Muslim Brotherhood took power with the blessings of the IMF. And basically reverse any gains that revolution won. Revolutionary leadership is necessary for another reason. Human beings think and view the world in highly symbolic terms. And large-scale organization among human beings generally requires having a symbol of some sort to rally around, whether that's a flag or a religious symbol, a charismatic leader, and so on. Things that embody moral meaning and physically represent the principles that the group, the movement, or the nation believes in and is fighting for. Revolutionary leaders embody the principles of the revolution they lead. And that can be a tremendous source of inspiration and unity as people rally around them, as people gravitate to them. The images of people like Lenin, Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, Mao Zedong, Ho Chi Minh, and many others continue to inspire people to this day, long after their deaths, because of the symbolic power that these revolutionary leaders had. They represented a new way forward for humanity. And their heroic personal example solidified the socialist ideal in the minds of millions of people, allowing whole new societies to be built in countries around the world, bringing prosperity and economic development to some of the economic and social development to some of the most impoverished peoples on our planet. And to date, no leaderless movement, quote-unquote, has succeeded in doing anything even remotely comparable. You know, and remember something Gerald Horn said earlier in the interview he did on the Real News Network. You know, it's very important to remember that the USSR built a modern society by empowering working people, by empowering formerly oppressed people, you know, not by enslaving people and making them work for free for 200 years like the United States did in order to create the conditions for a modern society. The USSR and other socialist countries built a modern society by empowering people. By empowering formerly oppressed people. And that's a very strong statement of what socialism can do and what revolutionary leadership can inspire people to do. And that's a very important thing to remember. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Небо утреннего стяг, жизни важен первый шаг. Слышишь, веют над страною ветры яростных атак. И вновь продолжает собой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. Весь летит во все концы, вы поверьте нам, отцы. Будут новые победы, станут новые бойцы. И вновь продолжает собой, сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. С неба милости не жди, жизнь для правды не щади. Нам, ребята, в этой жизни только с правдой по пути. И вновь продолжает собой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди.
Октябрь впереди.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was a song by Lev Lechenko, a Soviet singer. And the song is called Lenin Kakoy Maladoy, which is Lenin means Lenin is young again. And really, it's a song that really speaks to the power that the image that Lenin, the image of Lenin really continues to inspire. You know, of course, you know, he's a very heroic man, you know, very heroic revolutionary. And, you know, the inspiration which he had on people, you know, that lasted long after his death. You know, and, you know, and still continues to inspire people today. I mean, his image continues to inspire people today. Just like, you know, the images of Che Guevara and people like that, you know, continue to inspire people, you know, and their words and their, and the thing, and their deeds and all these things which live on. You know, a very powerful part of revolutionary leadership that continues to galvanize people to support revolutionary causes. Now, the way I conceive of the universalist order, you know, in my book, you know, where I conceive of this organization which is going to provide a leadership role, revolutionary leadership role in the socialist state, in the new socialist society I envision. The universalist order is to be a organization that will provide leadership for working class struggles worldwide. It's going to be an international organization. Just as the Bolshevik Party, it will follow Lenin's call for a party of a new type, made up of professional revolutionaries who have dedicated their lives to the destruction of capitalism and to the construction of socialism. The revolutionary construction of socialism. In the context of the Universal Republic, the future federation of socialist states that will be able to combat capitalism on a global scale, the Universalist Order will be the institution of executive leadership, as well as an international vanguard organization, spurring proletarians to revolutionary action all over the world. The Universalist Order will provide leadership to the Proletarian Guard, and its members will be drawn from the ranks of the Proletarian Guard, and it will exist to serve the Proletarian Guard as the embodiment of the international working class. You know, as I said in last week's show, you know, the various executive and judicial authorities will have accountability. They will remain accountable to the Proletarian Guard as the legislative body. The Universalist Order will consist of men and women selected from the first echelon of the Proletarian Guard. The section of the Guard consisting of people who have voluntarily dedicated their lives to the cause of world socialism. In the Universal Republic, professional police, professional soldiers, civil servants, as well as those in positions of judicial and executive leadership must be members of the first echelon. It's a precondition. Which means that they have volunteered for the section of the Proletarian Guard that is at the highest level. It will be at the highest level of combat readiness and will be the first to be mobilized in defense of the socialist state in the event of a crisis or war. Because if you remember last week when I talked about the Proletarian Guard has a military function, you know, for the defense of the socialist state. And, you know, all adult citizens will have military training to that end. But only certain sections will be mobilized depending on the gravity of the situation, the need for the defense of the socialist state. You know, how great the emergency is, and the first echelon is the first to be mobilized. And of course, it's made up of people who have volunteered for that. The Communist Party of the Soviet Union collapsed in part, it's very important to remember, it collapsed in part because its dedication and commitment to the cause of socialist revolution had lapsed and degraded. This must never be allowed to happen again. Only men and women of proven and militant dedication should be allowed into positions of authority in the socialist state. You know, especially positions of executive authority. The Universalist Order will function as the command staff of the proletariat and operate as a military organization bound by revolutionary discipline. This is something Lenin talked about a lot, is the need for discipline and unity in revolutionary struggle. Like the Proletarian Guard, the Universalist Order is dedicated to the destruction of capitalism worldwide and coordinates the international class struggle to this end. You know, it really is a coordinating body. Within the Universal Republic, the Universalist Order will provide executive leadership at every level of society, from the local to the international. coordinating economic planning, public administration, and military organization in collaboration with the elected representatives of the Proletarian Guard. Members of First Echelon will serve as public servants or ministerials under the leadership of the Universalist Order, as will military officers. Professional police and public servants engaged in judicial matters will likewise be made up of First Echelon members, but will instead be led by the Judicator Order of Revolutionary Judges that makes up the judicial authority of the Universal Republic. And of course, I'll talk about that in a future show. The Universalist Order is a body of political and military leaders. In Proletarian God, I describe the order as a kind of knighthood in the service of socialism. And I don't believe that this is an anachronism to use that term, knighthood. The leaders of the proletariat must dedicate their lives and be prepared to give their lives for their cause. They are warriors in the service of socialism. And they must live in accordance with their principles. They must live in accordance with their principles and set an example in everything they do. You know, this really is the Communist International taken to a whole new level. You know, we have this worldwide body of men and women who have dedicated their lives to the service of socialism, to the destruction of capitalism, and, you know, they adhere to these principles which they live their lives by. And they're dedicated to the class struggle in this deeper manner. You know, so that's really why I use the term knighthood, you know, to refer to this. In the class struggle, they will be faced with an enemy that is both extremely brutal and extremely deceptive. You know, I've talked in past shows about the nature of the capitalist state and really the horrific nature of the capitalist state and the things that it does around the world, especially if we're talking about U.S. imperialism. You know, it's extremely brutal and extremely deceptive, wearing a kindly face, even as it exploits and destroys the lives of millions. The leaders of the working class must always work to expose the true enemies of the people and show them for what they are, monsters. Proletarian leaders must likewise work to raise the consciousness of the people, so that they will not be fooled or taken advantage of by reactionary forces. The proletariat must not allow itself to be the pawns of monsters and instead become a class of monster slayers. The example of socialist leaders as the vanguard of socialist revolution is crucial. It's crucial in this respect. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
She has stepped aside. just begun. For a glory wish, there is much to sacrifice. So many farewells, many tears you must shed before your journey ends. Oh, it's only just begun. For a glory wish, there is much to sacrifice.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, that was Power Symphony with Way of the Sword. Now, once again, we're talking about my book, Proletarian God, Building the Socialist Future, and about this organization of executive authority called the Universalist Order. The Universalist Order will be the officer corps of the working class, tasked with coordinating and directing the war effort against capitalism, using all the means and resources available to advance the cause of working class liberation. In this international struggle, the order will be led by its general staff, with a council of marshals holding supreme executive authority within each nation of the Universal Republic, and a council of imperators exercising this authority internationally. Imperator is a Latin word, roughly translating as supreme commander, and the imperators, as the supreme executive authority within the Universal Republic, will be responsible for coordinating the class struggle worldwide. The executive of the Universal Republic operates as a kind of modified military junta, commanding and directing armed force in defense of the socialist state and in defense of proletarian class interests throughout the world. Given the nature of socialism's enemies, such a centralized military leadership is essential. Too many lives have been lost. Effective measures must be taken to ensure the security of working class life around the world. And the only way to do this is to wage unrelenting struggle against capitalism and imperialism. As communists, we follow a revolutionary tradition almost 3 millennia old. We follow in the titanic footsteps of Cypselus, the first revolutionary leader, when he stood at the vanguard of the movement that smashed the Bacchidae aristocracy in Corinth in 650 BC. We continue to walk the path of revolution to this day down the centuries. The working class is not a collection of helpless little people, but a slumbering titan of unimaginable power, a titan that revolutionaries strive to awaken. The revolutions of the 20th century transformed the world beyond recognition and transformed millions of downtrodden people into giants.